Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it's another edition of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant. Hi there, Paul.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, we're continuing this discussion on foundational questions that you ask in creating a trust for a client. And you wanted to review a little bit of this and some of the kinds of questions you ask that you don't think other people do.
Right. This is a really important conversation. Number one, it kind of sets up that if a listener were to engage with us, what could they expect? That's a good thing. Expectations, aligning expectations are really good in relationships. So we've talked about, who the trust makers, what to name a trust, who's in power and control of the trust. We've talked about what happens if someone's not feeling well. We call that disability in our process. And we've talked about a successor trustee. What are some of the things that we need to look for if someone else is going to manage our money and take over? And today's show, we're going to stay with those kind of two topics, actually. Mm-hmm. We're going to stay and hunker down in that a little bit more, which is, what are some of the things that we need to look out for? How and why do we need good documents to ensure that we are safe as clients? And what's the difference between maybe what we do compared to what I've seen out in the marketplace? And we're going to continue the conversation also about successor trustees. What power do they have? And who can they use money for if indeed they come in and they have the unfettered opportunity to have access to my bank accounts and investment accounts and everything else? So unfortunately, we hear the stories that someone is named as a successor trustee or a power of attorney agent with finances. And then all of a sudden we hear the story that someone's not acting rightfully. They're not acting with integrity and someone's stealing the money. And those are sad, sad stories. But I think with good estate planning, it mitigates that risk and actually limits the opportunity.
How does it
and
mitigate
risk.
That risk?
So,
here's an earmark. If the successor trustee is doing X, then we need to do this.
And so one of the reasons that I tend to lean towards trust as a better estate planning document is that there are higher responsibilities and fiduciary duties than there are in a financial power of attorney. So both instruments mandate that the principal or the trust maker is taken care of, that money is used for them. As a matter of fact, a financial power of attorney says it can only be used for them. Trusts are a little bit different, and we'll get into who can money be used for if I am incapacitated. Also, there are what I consider to be better guidelines in accounting, and we can put in integrity clauses for other people to look at and watch over a successor trustee. Those guardrails, even though they exist in a financial power of attorney, are much more difficult to follow. And what I find is that a trust has more legal teeth. It bites harder. Should a trustee be acting nefariously. If they are not doing their job well, then the trust can bite them more. And not only that, but courts tend to favor trusts and versus power of attorneys, again, are far more general. And a trust can be more specific. So therefore, the specific instructions, it does two things simultaneously. Number one, it gives your successor trustee confidence that they are doing the right thing. And when they do the right thing, the trust protects them very, very well. But it also gives specific instructions so that when they're not doing well, then it is more clear, because general instructions, it's hard to see with clarity when someone is doing something that is not accurate. So a trust, I think, is actually the best of both worlds. It protects a successor trustee very, very well when they do well. But it also bites them and grabs them harshly if indeed they are not doing well, and there are better recourses for beneficiaries in the trust, the successor beneficiary with beneficiaries down the road, they have more immediate rights compared to an estate and what happens through an agent with a financial power of attorney. Mm. So I typically favor trusts because it protects people better, whether it is the client, whether it's the trustee, or whether it's the beneficiary.
So they have a lot of power as a trustee, and even on what they do with assets, is that part of this power that they have?
Yeah, definitely. And so there are always general instructions in any trust or in any financial power of attorney. So I've made mention in a previous show that in every single one of my trusts, there's a banking authority. And that banking authority looks exactly the same in almost every trust I do. Why? Because banking authority is coming from a statutory perspective, and so I use the law to make sure that a person has access to it. So there are a lot of opportunities, and most individuals are going to give great discretion and great power to a successor trustee. But like we talked about in our previous show last week, and of course you can find all our previous podcasts back at legacyandfaith.com, we talked about how about higher risk investments such as cryptocurrencies, trading on margins. So there are areas where we may want to bring in some boundaries and give greater guidance to how a successor trustee is going to use the money for our benefit. But that's really one of the things that a trust should do much, much better than a financial power of attorney. And unfortunately, again, I'm going to talk a lot about templated trusts, which is I rarely see this in most trusts of what I'm about ready to say. Okay. So a trust should also give very clear instructions to support and assist the disabled trust maker. And I think that these questions that I ask are unique, and they are deeper than what I have seen written in almost any other trust that I have reviewed. So, for example, we're giving really good instructions to a successor trustee that gives them a high level of confidence that they're doing the right thing. And when they do the right thing, then that document protects them. And not only that, but to the trust maker, to my client, it gives them a higher level of emotional security that they left better instructions behind. So I think that's a win-win for everybody across the board. Mm. The client feels better, and the person who is taking the controls feels better. So for example, is it a high priority to a client that they be taken care of at their home? Or would they prefer to be taken care of at a different care level facility? Now, majority of my clients, I would probably say, I don't know, just off the top of my head, a good 70 to 80% would say, actually, if it's possible, I would prefer to stay at home and be cared for at home. And
anything's possible, but some of these things cost considerably.
They do. And so then that's where we have to look holistically of whether that choice is reasonable in light of the finances that they have, or do they have long-term care insurance? Will that come in and assist with some tax-free money? Because that policy would then enact because you can't take care of yourself. Let's say you meet the qualifications of the long-term care, and all of a sudden we have tax-free money coming your way for a period of years. That helps mitigate those costs, because you're right. Cost is getting more and more. I have several clients, even right now, that are being cared for at home to the tune of a little over $20,000 a month. Wow. So it is not a cheap option. So we have to look at how long would you want to be cared for? Do we have the proper finances to be cared for? At what level of care do we need to move you to a facility? So what would that facility look like? If you wanted to go to a different care unit, do you have certain values that you would want the family and your healthcare representative to look at we actually ask these questions to clients. So for many people, they would have a strong desire to say, I want to be cared for in a Christian community. Great, not a problem. Or in a Catholic community. Or in, that part of my life is not the most important thing. I want to make sure that the facility has a high reputation and has the highest medical care available. Great. How about cleanliness? How about being close to a spouse if you're married? So do you want to sacrifice maybe some of the characteristics that you're hoping for to be at a place that is closer to your spouse so that your spouse has an easier time to come and visit you? Or what if one of your children is taking care of you? Is it better to be near them in a closer location? So all of these questions that I've just rattled off the top of my head, I'm not so sure that many other estate planners are ever asking this. Now, if I was taking care of my parents, wouldn't these be great questions for me to know about how they want to be cared for and how I am to use their money? If they have said, staying at home is my highest value, so bring in nurses, bring in people to help clean, bring in individuals, meals on wheels or whatever it takes to bring in healthy food. If I know that, versus many people have a desire to say, I want to be well taken care of, but ensuring that there is something to pass on. Some people have a very high value to say, I want to make sure that I leave something to my kids. Okay, great. We can balance those, but then there's decisions that we need to make in between to balance those values of a client. We need to know what those values are. So these type of questions, I'm not so sure that I see them. As a matter of fact, boy, in the years I've been practicing, Mark, I have yet to ever see these questions in a trust document that I have ever reviewed, ever. So that means that the trustee is given power, but without clarity of what to do in these circumstances. And we know the statistics. 75% of individuals who are 65 years or older, okay, so if you've reached 65 years old, you have a 3 in 4 chance that at some point in your life, you are going to need someone else to assist you at some level. So if that is true, if you have a 75% chance that these questions are going to need to be given to somebody to facilitate your care, don't you think they're really good questions to ask right now? When we have clarity of mind, when we have a better vision of what our finances are, and maybe that spurs people into saving a little bit more to accomplish those goals. So it means that they need to rearrange some of their finances in order to accomplish it. So because there is a higher probability than not that we are going to need assistance, I think these are some of the most critical questions I ask to a client to ensure that we have a full, deep, rich estate plan to ensure that the client is the first priority and well taken care of during their lifetime.
Some of the foundational questions in creating a trust for you and your family, and Paul will ask those of you if you come in and use his services. How do people do that, Paul?
Head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, and ways to communicate with us all found at legacyandfaith.com.
Okay, taking a quick break and back with more of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Can I avoid probate? Will I lose everything if my health becomes compromised? How do I preserve what I have for me and my family? Will the government take it all? This is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. These are some of the most common questions we get on a daily basis, and there are solutions for all of these issues. It is time for you to protect your family and what God has placed under your stewardship, and we can help. Go to legacyandfaith.com to find out more about our services and upcoming educational opportunities. That's Legacy and Faith.
Your photos, slides, scrapbooks, and home movies are invaluable and irreplaceable. Barry Kenny here with the Bear Services. Call us to save them as digital files to be stored electronically and shared liberally. We will even come to you so they stay in your possession. Go to thebearservices.com for more information. That's thebearservices.com.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant, and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, we're looking at those foundational questions that Paul will ask of you as he's creating a trust for you and your family. And we kind of left off with a lot of pretty deep health-related questions.
Right.
And you want to talk more about the kinds of health care issues, the health care power of attorney, some of these ideas that need to be taken care of.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. We always need a health care power of attorney. So we do a lot of work when we create an estate plan on the trust that manages all of the finances. So we've given instructions to the successor trustee. They know the values of how to use the money. We just established that there may be instructions to say, I want to be cared for at home, or I want you to go ahead and purchase things that will make me more mobile and keep my independence to the greatest degree possible. So those are questions that we ask clients. So now we have a minor disconnect because that's talking about the money. Mm. But now we need someone to come in and make sure that the healthcare decisions are appropriately being done. So the trust or the financial power of attorney, that's the money power, okay? So now what about who talks to the doctors? And we need a healthcare power of attorney. Every person needs a healthcare power of attorney. If you're unable to communicate with a doctor, or if a doctor does not believe that you are comprehending or understanding the severity and nature of the questions being asked, they're going to want to turn to someone else and look to get their thoughts. So who is empowered? Now, most people's experiences, if you've ever gone through this, if you've helped parents through this process, helped friends or siblings, I've just walked through this process with anyone else in your life, what you may have seen or experienced is that the family is there, they're all having a discussion with the doctor, and everyone goes, "That doctor, that's great, let's do that." And no one's ever asked for a healthcare power of attorney. Mm. As a matter of fact, that's probably the most common scenario, is that a healthcare power of attorney is not asked for. Mm. Why? Because the family, the individuals around the person who needs the health care, they're agreeing with the proposed care plan. They are saying, yes, that's what is in this person's best interest. We're going to take your advice, doctor. Let's move forward. But what happens when someone goes, actually, no, that's not what my mom, that's not what my dad would want, that's not what my spouse would want? When that then comes to the forefront, when that circumstance happens, now the doctors are going to be in a pickle because they have laid out a care plan, and by their own code of ethics, they need to do what's in the best interest of the client. That's why they laid it out. That's their belief. Someone else now is saying, no, there's a higher probability at that moment in time that they're going to say, okay, if we're not going to do what I'm recommending, then I need to see some type of authority that I can be called off from that plan and that I can do something different. Now enter in the healthcare power of attorney. So for a high majority, at least from stories I've heard, from clients and things I've seen in my lifetime, most of the time the healthcare power of attorney is never asked for because the family is agreeing with the healthcare plan. But as soon as it's a no, as soon as there's something else, as soon as someone says, I want to go home and I want to spend my last days at home.
Yeah, I don't want the cancer treatment anymore.
Right, exactly.
Or I don't want to be kept alive artificially.
Now, if that comes from the client, or from the patient at this point, then the doctors are probably going to go ahead and release on own cognizance. But what if I'm the one who's saying, I've had intense conversations with my parents, and I am positive that this is not what they don't want those treatments. Mm-hmm. They want to be released. Do I have the legal authority to release my parents to not take the treatments, and that's where the healthcare power of attorney is going to enter in. I've also seen it in just in something as simple as dealing with pharmacists. So if the client is unable to pick up medications, to order medications, and things like this, then pharmacists are going to be more likely than doctors, actually, in what I have seen, to ask for a healthcare power of attorney just so that they know that they can release medications and other things like this to the person who's appointed. So healthcare power of attorneys have, again, just based upon my experience, pharmacists tend to ask for them more often than doctors. So a healthcare power of attorney is going to who do we trust to make the healthcare decisions? And that may be someone who is very different than the person who manages the finances. Mm-hmm. So someone who manages finances, very detailed. They are administrative in nature. They are able to keep good files. But maybe your healthcare power of attorney is someone who's far more compassionate. Maybe you have a family member who is in the medical industry in one way or another and knows how to talk shop compared to someone else. So it could be a very good decision to split these duties. Mm. Number one, someone's already managing all the finances, having to make financial decisions. And then we've got now medical decisions to be made. And then the healthcare power of attorney, very important document. In addition, there's a mental health power of attorney. In Washington state, we have a different mental health statute. So therefore, because it's a different statute, in my process, we create a standalone mental health power of attorney that matches that statute instead of just a general clause in a healthcare power of attorney. Mm-hmm. So I talk to people that says the healthcare power of attorney manages the things that we can touch and have surgery on and do the things that we can fix. The mental health power of attorney are the things that we don't see. It's if our thought life or our emotional life are not exactly in the same control as what we are used to. Mm-hmm. And so that could be an important document. How about HIPAA authorization? Most of them are stuck within a healthcare power of attorney, but many healthcare power of attorneys are only turned on if the client is deemed disabled. So now I can't get to records because maybe that document is not yet active. Mm. So we create a standalone HIPAA authorization that has nothing to do with disability or not. It's automatically turned on.
And of course, part of the trust.
Yeah. Okay. So these are different documents that you'll find in our system that I don't see in other people's system. And now I do see HIPAA authorizations in some other reviews that I've done. So that one is a more common. The mental health tends to be wrapped up in the regular healthcare document, and not much is given to the mental health side. But boy, specifically our young people right now, if you have a 20 or 30 year old, they're under different stresses. They need estate planning. And if not just for these healthcare documents alone and a financial power of attorney, with some of the struggles that they go through nowadays. So it hurts my heart to watch our younger generation go through some of the anxiety and mental health issues, and the suicide rates are, it hurts. Mm. So that generation needs good healthcare documents as well. And then an end of life document. So what happens if you are on life support? How long would you want to remain on life support? What instructions would you give? So if you were deemed by two doctors to that there is nothing that they can medically do any longer, and if you are on artificial life support, and it's just keeping you alive. So in other words, a machine is going to do the work and you're no longer going to do any of the work. How long do you want to be kept alive in that circumstance? Do you want to be let go right away? It's just time to go see Jesus. Do you want to make sure that there's a specified number of days to make sure that the doctors are right? Mm-hmm. How about hydration at that time? How about a feeding tube? And hydration, there's mixes there from what I understand and what I talk to clients about. Hydration can ease the dying process, but it can also keep you alive longer if you have an IV of of hydration, because at an end of life, let's assume that you're not able to swallow or eat the ice cubes any longer.
This kind of specificity can be in the trust.
Well, this is not the trust. This is a different document, because the trust manages the money. So now I'm talking about your health care documents. Okay. But yes, in estate planning, this type of specificity should be in asked to clients. And then do you want pain medication? And most people say, heck yes, give me the good stuff at the end of life, right? I don't want to know pain. And really, that could be a decision for those who are around you as well, because there may be perceived pain. So these decisions are all necessary in an end-of-life document. So all of these medical, however, they bolster how do we care for a client first. We have the money taken care of because we have the right trustee. We've given them good instructions. Pay for these things. Make sure I'm well taken care of on the financial front. Now we've created a litany of different documents that then speak to how am I going to be cared for and who makes and who is empowered to make my medical decisions, my mental health decisions, and the end-of-life decision. I don't want to leave someone else with an end-of-life decision for myself. I want to speak what I want done with my body, take off that responsibility. It is a critical document, a necessary document, a horrible conversation, but a necessary document to make sure that we don't leave that on someone else's shoulders. All these documents are necessary in the process.
Okay, some of Paul Grant's process when he sets up a trust for you, foundational questions that he's been going through. You like his approach. You want to find out more, how it might be able to help you and your family. How do people get in touch with you, Paul?
Head over to legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, ways to communicate and connect and get you on schedules and meet you, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
This is the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.